dead-eyed month, head swimming from working each night until I passed out, having my work torn apart by the three men the next day, cycling endlessly, it seemed, rolling from office to grungy home, back to office. Until finally Ray Locke, who wrote screenplays and gentle southern-based stories when he wasn't editing and teaching me, took pity on me and invited me to a small party at his home, where I met Brett Howard, who called herself Lady Brett, and Faulkner. Lady Brett was old, ancient, or so it seemed to me, with gray hair losing its battle with age, and gimlet-looking eyes that showed she was nearly blind through glasses so thick they could almost have been made with the proverbial Coke bottle bottoms. Bent in every conceivable way by time, she had two things that fought the age. Absolutely perfect white teeth that flashed from the wrinkled old face like beacons of youth, and a voice that was so beautiful, soft, low, and southern, it seemed to have been dipped in honey. Though she was very old, the teeth and the voice made her beautiful in some wonderful way. I met her sitting in a corner of Ray's living room, sipping some kind of amber drink and petting a small dog in her lap. "Hello," she said. "The dog's name is Faulkner." I told her my name. I was completely enchanted by her, but in a strange way, as if there was something about her I would never understand but would always think about, always remember, always want to tell people. The dog was small, curly-haired, and it occupied her lap rather than sat in it. "After the writer," I said. "The dog, his name." She nodded. "A small joke," she said. "I knew him and helped him to work on a story called The Reavers." "You help writers?" She shook her head. "Not all. Just the weak ones. I knew Hemingway as well."
"Did you help him?"
"No, he was too hard-boiled and had a bad future coming."
"How did you know that?"
"Faulkner," she said, smiling. "The dog, I mean. He's psychic. He knows things. Sometimes I think he knows all things."
"But how does he communicate? Does he speak?"
The overall bluntness of much of my life, the enforced reality of it, kept me from completely believing in things like psychic abilities, especially those from animals or other possible fairy tales. Still, I knew there were things beyond anything I understood, and I was not completely negative.
"He speaks to me with his eyes, body language. We have been together all his life, and so we know. We know each other so well."
"Does he say anything about me?" She hesitated for a moment and then said, "You will never be satisfied or content, and a girl or a woman named Gretchen wants to speak with you about steak. And soon you will take a long trip to a place that smells truly awful." Like that. Just rattled it out. Not to speak or argue about it or even discuss it. Just let it come and then dropped it. And it floored me completely. I didn't know about the being happy or content part, but she couldn't possibly have known about Gretchen unless she or the dog were truly gifted, and I didn't find out about the stinky place until later that night, when I got a call from a half-uncle named Art, who had a sheep farm slash ranch in northern Minnesota. He had 400 ewes due to lamb, most of them through twins, some triplets, and his problem came because he had gotten last year's wool bonus check, and it seemed that it was the same amount of money that they wanted for one of them new Chrysler automobile cars. And so he bought a new car. A new Chrysler automobile car. That had a circular speedometer, as he put it, that went all the way around to 100 miles in a single hour. 100 miles an hour. So he had to try it. and at 87 miles an hour, the Chrysler decided to abandon the road in favor of a small curve in the Necktie River, where it flipped end for end, cleanly breaking Art's back and throwing him clear, before sinking in about 12 feet of stinking mud and sludge locally called turtle poop. He was calling now from a circular frame hospital bed in his small living room, where he had to reside for the next couple of months, and would I please come and help him get through lambing? The long trip, from Hollywood to northern Minnesota. The stinky place. Nothing smells like a sheep barn with 400 or 500 sheep crammed in. The waste turns to raw ammonia, which blinds you and almost literally rips your nose off your face. Faulkner and Brett were dead right. And so it was. I flew from Los Angeles to Bemidji, Minnesota, and Art sent an old man named Louis, older than weather, older than dirt, the 40 miles to pick me up at the airport in an ancient truck, and in 2 days, I was in the middle of lambing. Somewhere in some time long ago, wild sheep living on wild pastures with wild rams breeding wild ewes, there must have been tough, wild lambs being born, where mothers protected lambs, could protect their offspring, and shelter them, and teach them to live. Then man took over with genetic breeding concepts and altered the animal to produce more and more wool, thicker and fatter meat, and virtually no brain at all. And the upshot is what we have now. Ewes that have to be almost literally hand-carried through lambing, coddled and sheltered, or many of them would simply walk away from the lamb when it was born. The end result is that lambing on any sizable farm or ranch is a 24-hour-a-day job, sleeping in your clothes, grabbing a sandwich now and then, dozing standing in a corner or lying on straw and hoping it is free of sheep urine and manure, which it usually isn't. Art had a system that he had worked out over the many years he had been farming, and while it was relatively simple, it still demanded a staggering amount of stamina. It was spring, late March, with alternately cold and wet weather, now and then a chance of light snow. The sheep, there were 450 or so, were kept outside in a small forest-sheltered pasture to the rear of a large metal barn. The barn was divided into 12 smaller pens, each with a thick layer of fresh straw for them to bed in. The problem with the sheep was that in the shock and pain of birthing, if she was left in the herd, she would often lose track of her lamb, and the lamb would die. So a 24-hour watch was kept on them by sitting outside under the eaves of the barn, and when a ewe began to go into labor, she was quickly taken into the barn and put in the first pen alone, where she would have her lamb, and be left with it for a day or two. Then she would be moved to the next pen, with one or two other ewes and their lambs, and then a third pen with 5 or 6 ewes, so in the end, she knew her own lamb, even in a crowd of them. That's if everything went smoothly. If, however, things got out of hand, say, a ewe died or couldn't feed her lamb or didn't want to feed her lamb, or the lamb died or didn't want to nurse on the ewe, then a can of cheap hairspray would be sprayed on the lamb's back and squirted into the ewe's nostrils, so she would smell the odor and think it was her lamb. And the new pair had to be watched continuously for 2 or 3 days to make sure it all worked, while watching outside for the next ewe going into labor, while moving them from pen to pen, while not sleeping or resting. It was, very nearly, physically impossible. True, Art had an old and very experienced man, Louis, to help him, although Louis was so shattered and warped by arthritis that he could barely move and kept going in and out of a kind of semi-senility when he became exhausted. He would watch and know precisely when a ewe was starting labor, had a wonderful knowledge of sheep, but could barely move. And then Art had me, eager, enthusiastic, willing to help but with energy more like a chicken with its head cut off. Louis would point at a ewe, and I would streak out to bring her into the barn, except that they all looked alike, and in the dark or soft rain, I would get the wrong one and frequently get dragged on my face in the muck for my effort. Had it been just the two of us with the flock, I'm sure it would have been a complete disaster. But Louis came with a helper, partner, friend, second brain. A border collie named, he must have wanted the similarities in names, Louise. And she quickly, after watching me for a moment and seeing how useless I was, took over completely. When I first saw Louise, she seemed to be floating about 2 feet off the ground, levitating. Louis brought me from the airport and I changed clothes in Art's house, admired his bed, he was very proud of it, and went to the barn where the sheep were beginning their cycle. Louis, in broken English, he had about a 10-ton Scandinavian accent, had tried to explain the procedure to me as we drove from the airport, but most of what I heard was, "When they come to sick, we bring them into barns." As soon as I was dressed in old clothes, Louis dragged me to the back of the barn, and we settled in to watch. Except, I was seeing things. It was a misty, cold evening, just dark, with a heavy, low-lying fog, and even with the light on the back of the barn, it was impossible to see anything. More correctly, impossible to see any sheep. Instead, floating about 2.5 feet off the ground, lying wrapped in a tight little ball with her nose tucked under her tail, was a small black-and-white border collie, dozing in midair. Before I could say anything, she stood, still in midair, took a step to the side, and dropped, vanishing down into the fog. Seconds later, she came to the barn door, pushing a reluctant ewe who was starting labor. Once she delivered the ewe, she took a step away from me, hopped up onto the nearest sheep, and ran back across the backs of the ewes, jumping sheep to sheep until she was about in the center of the flock, where she sat, apparently in midair, carefully watching around her for the next sheep. It was all so cooperative. She sat on the sheep, or if she felt like resting, actually lay on them, curled in a ball, watching, or I think in reality sensing, I don't see how she could have actually seen them in the fog, the sheep, until one started labor. They didn't seem to mind her being up there. Indeed, they almost seemed to like it, pushing together to make a more firm bed when she lay down. And if I meddled and tried to get out there and drag a ewe in from the pen, Louise would straighten me out by pushing me away with her shoulder and taking over. My job was soon relegated to working in the pens, moving the sheep from one to the next to let them learn to recognize their lambs before it got more crowded. I was little more than a clerk, and that was fine. And Louise and Louis and I worked those sheep and got into a rhythm so that Louise was doing all the work and we just supported her. It was like a dance in the stink of sheep and the smell of newborn steam coming off the lambs and the sound of them, mothers and lambs, finding one another and love. And it seemed that it would go on or had gone on forever, and that there had always been sheep and lambs and birth. And then the coyote came. At first I thought it was a wolf. They were coming back from having been hunted down for bounties. But as she came in the dark and I turned on the lights in the back of the barn, I could see that it was a large coyote. I would find later she was a female. She hit the back of the flock, tearing ears and udders, indiscriminate and savage, throats, stomachs, rear ends, disabling 6 or 7 sheep in less than 2 or 3 minutes, a horrible attack. Louise tried to intervene, but the coyote shouldered her aside, tore at her neck, and went back to the sheep. It is not politically correct, but true, that I had seen and heard of single coyotes or wolves killing 40 sheep in one night without eating any of them. Art had a gun, a pre-Second World War surplus clunker of a thing, which he kept in the barn. I grabbed it, swung it up, swore at the sights on it, which were rusted and crude, saw the coyote in the dim light mixed with sheep and Louise, and took quick aim. Let the army training kick in. I squeezed one round off and heard thwack, tick. Two hits. God, I thought. Not Louise. Please, God, not her. And it wasn't. She had gone right when I fired slightly to the left, and I caught the coyote fair in the front of her neck, killing her almost instantly. The bullet had gone cleanly through and struck a ewe in the backbone, killing her almost as fast as the coyote. I ran from the barn out through the herd to make certain and saw that the coyote was really dead, as was the sheep. But I ran smack into what makes border collies the incredible beings that they are. Louise grabbed at the coyote's neck, growling, and having made certain that it was dead, tried to bring the sheep back to life. She pulled at the ewe, trying to lift her to her feet, nudged at her ribs in a kind of crude CPR, smelled for the dead ewe's breath, found none, went back to CPR, and when that failed, started dragging the ewe to the barn where Louie was emerging. I leaned down and grabbed at the ewe's leg to help, thinking that possibly we could save the lamb, but Louise would have none of it. She looked at me, at the rifle, growled, bared her teeth at me, at the rifle. She seemed to blame us both, and was not about to forgive either one of us, me or the rifle. Ever. The spring and lambing wore on and on for 2, 3, 4 more weeks with no sleep and Louie watching and Louise sleeping on the herd and me moving animals from pen to pen. When there was a moment's rest, I would try to pet Louise, but she never allowed me close again, would dismiss me with a soft growl and a push with her nose or shoulder. I had done a bad thing. I had done the worst thing, the very worst thing. I had killed one of the flock. No, I had killed one of her flock. No matter that it was an accident, no matter that I killed the coyote that was savaging the flock, savaging her flock, or that I loved dogs and sheep and all animals, except perhaps mosquitoes and wood ticks, I would not be brought back into the fold, into her fold, her family. I could be around, could help in the pens, but we could never be close again. I had gone too far. And I still miss her. Chapter 4. On Birds and Bees and Rest Area Non-Negotiated Hostile Existence. Much is made of the inability of the wildness of nature to blend into and mix with what man has done to the world. There was an enormous amount of worry involving the Alaska pipeline and caribou, and whether or not the pipe would act as an iron barrier and stop the normal migration patterns of the caribou. In that event, there was no need for concern. The caribou indeed seemed not to notice the pipeline at all. In truth, in almost all cases of the meeting of the two worlds, wild and so-called civilized, there rarely seems to be much difficulty. I was sitting on the side apron at Los Angeles International Airport some years ago, waiting in a long line of commercial jets, which were roaring and snorting flame, and looked out the side window of the plane, and was amazed to see a scruffy coyote stalking an even grubbier-looking jackrabbit in the grass divider between the runways. Neither of them seemed to notice the giant silver beasts around them. I watched the two until we were out of sight, taking off, both still intent on their drama, as oblivious to the plains as if they were alone in the forest primeval. Nor was that the only evidence that the wild has supplanted the tame. One hot summer desert day, I was riding my horse on the edge of an ancient dry lake bed, slightly higher on the old shoreline, when I looked out to see at some distance, perhaps half a mile, a jackrabbit ripping out across the dusty bed, leaving a dust line like a bone-dry contrail. Behind it, gaining slightly, came two other lines of dust, made by two hungry coyotes, and they were clever enough to work the rabbit from side to side, each of them working out to the edge to keep him from turning, manipulating him toward the center between them, slower and slower until the rabbit seemed doomed. While prairie jackrabbits are capable of amazing bursts of speed, up to and over 50 miles an hour, they are relatively short-winded. When working the way this one was being worked, played in from the side, unless they could find some cover to dodge and jerk and hide in, or a safe haven, they were pretty much consigned to death. A cruel death. If you spend a lot of time with nature, you inevitably run into the concept, the reality, of death. It comes to all living things. While now and then you hear somebody talking about how beautiful and elegant the predator-prey relationship is, how natural and proper the death of the prey is, it is usually so much misunderstood balderdash by people who have not witnessed it very many times, or worse, by people who have witnessed only highly edited versions on film. In truth, it is always cruel. It is often said that nature has no disdain, and therefore the natural death lacks the concept of anger, of revenge, of meanness, and that it is even sometimes, shudder, beautiful. Perhaps, but only in the way the stupid, bloody slaughter of a bull in a bullfight can be called beautiful. The truth is, the bull is virtually maimed and tortured, hacked and cut and stabbed until it is near death, and then ceremoniously stabbed with a sword. Conversely, most animals do not kill before they eat, and the prey is often eaten slowly, miserably, and alive, in great torture and pain. While initially as a hunter-trapper when a child, and also later, I had witnessed the concept and reality of death, as new knowledge, it had now become something of less interest to me, especially after having worked on an ambulance for 2 years, with the attendant horror and nightmares that go with that. And I no longer had that first blush of excitement or thought I had a need to know. I decided not to see this particular story play out. Rabbits, in particular, make a soul-searing scream as they are eaten and die. And I started to turn the mare. Had already turned my own head away when I noticed that the mare had not. She had, in fact, turned slightly to face the coyotes and rabbit. She was a strange and in some ways wonderful horse, capable of an odd interest in things, and now and then great compassion. I watched her one day walking along, her nose down, studying a lizard in its meanderings. And once, when riding with a friend who had brought a very old deaf and blind little female dog for the ride, I saw the mare do something I would not have believed, nor would my friend, had we not both seen it. The little dog had always led the way, and now, though severely handicapped, still walked in front, still led, or tried to, as we moved up an old mining road trail in the mountains near my home. The dog became slower and slower, and the horses slower behind her, until, finally, she stopped and stood, staring at the ground, lost. The mare hesitated and reached her head down, and I worried because there are some horses, many horses, who will not put up with dogs. I was concerned that the mare might bite or kick or stomp her. But no, I was wrong. Instead, she took the front of her nose, that big, soft, quivering, gentle nose, put it against the little dog's rear end, and ever so gently nudge pushed her along so she could stay ahead of us, stay as the leader. It was just the kindest, sweetest thing. And now she had stopped, was watching the story unfold below us on the dry lake. I turned to watch with her, and was surprised to see there had been a change. The jackrabbit had dodged, dug in, taken a hard right turn, which apparently surprised the coyotes enough to throw their pace off, so that the rabbit maintained at least a small lead, coming straight at us. The dynamic had changed completely. Where the jackrabbit had been running straight and flat on the surface of the lake, with a coyote slightly to the rear on either side, the rabbit's only hope was to outrun the coyotes in a straight run, a vain hope. But now he left the lake, crossed the ancient shoreline into more broken country, easier for him to navigate, slightly harder for the coyotes, and for a moment as he dodged and zipped back and forth, he actually gained slightly, the coyotes' heavier bodies slowing them as they zigged and zagged, trying to catch him. Somehow I did not figure us, the horse and me, into the equation. In the past I'd had prey, in my case a snowshoe hare, come in and sit by me near a fire to avoid almost certain death by a weasel, and a wonderful old fisherman named Chris Tormanson told me of a doe, a small deer, that ran out on the ice and jumped into his boat with him on Lake Superior to avoid being captured by a pack of wolves. And again, I had a small doe, almost a fawn, barely out of spots, jump into a canoe with me as I sat fishing near the shore of a small lake in Minnesota to avoid being caught by domestic dogs, or nearly jump into the canoe. The effect was only a little short of biblical, with barking, gurgling, screaming dogs, swearing, gurgling, screaming fishermen, and a thrashing, tearing, panicking doe in a mess of rolling canoe, mud, and water. This somehow seemed more detached, as if I were really not in the picture and only an observer. For the moment. Then, suddenly, everything was upon us. The rabbit zigged one last time around a scruffy boulder, ducked under an ancient century plant, and stopped, dead, directly beneath the mare. Everything happened very fast, or I thought it would. The mare, Betty is her name, yet another Betty in my life, always took a very dim view of quick surprises. I will remember forever some of what happened when a balloon that had caught under a bush jiggled loose and floated up into her nose out of nowhere. The balloon had a face painted on it, a grimacing face, a face apparently meant to scare the peewadden. I do not know what that means. It's something my grandmother always said, out of horses. And I went from sitting in the saddle to sitting in an ocotillo cactus with no horse in sight and no knowledge about how it had happened. Heaven knew what would happen with a rabbit and two coyotes jammed in beneath her. And I had just about half a second to get ready for it when I realized I was mistaken. Nothing happened. The rabbit made one last smoking effort and came to a dust-explosive, shuddering stop directly beneath the mare, who stood absolutely still, looking first down beneath her front legs, back at the rabbit beneath her, and the two coyotes, who were standing, panting deeply, about 20 yards away. They were scruffy-looking buggers, very much like the coyotes in cartoons, and clearly not happy with events. But they were both older and wiser coyotes, and knew that even if I did not somehow intervene, coming under the mare to take the rabbit would be tantamount to committing suicide. So they held back. A time passed, maybe 30 seconds. The mare took a slow, cautious step. The rabbit hopped forward, holding his pace to match that of the mare. The mare took another step, two, three, and the rabbit matched it, following along beneath her. I turned to see the two coyotes following, about 30 feet to the rear, slightly to either side. Oh, I thought, good, a parade. How long could it last? How long would the rabbit stay sheltered under her? How long would she put up with it? And why, before she exploded and dumped me in a pile of cactus? How long before the coyotes figured out a strategy to dislodge the rabbit? If two trains started from opposite ends of the track, and one train was going 40 miles an hour, and the other 20 miles an hour, how long would it take? What, I thought, could I do to settle this thing? In the end, I knew there was nothing, and in the end, it settled itself. A roadrunner chased a small lizard from the left side in front of our traveling animal cavalcade. The lizard hopped. The roadrunner leaped, flapped its wings, and flew, banking directly into and past the coyotes, who instinctively took after the bird directly away from the rabbit, who took the opportunity to disappear into a thick stand of tangled, thorny mesquite. The mare twitched twice with her whole body, lunged left, then right, and tore off after the coyotes, as if she had discovered a new kind of follow-the-leader. For a quarter, then half a mile, she fairly smoked after the coyotes until they ran out into the dry river-slash-lake bed once again. There she stopped, breathing deeply, watching the coyotes disappear in the distance. I stood down and loosened the cinch and let her breathe all she could take in, and thought once more of how often I seemed to control things from my supposed platform of being a human, and therefore a superior being. My life had, for the last half hour, been completely controlled by a horse, two coyotes, a roadrunner, and a jackrabbit, not to mention the lizard. I was merely along for the ride, very precariously as it turned out, which reminded me once again how really minor man can be when it comes to competing for space and time and food. Or water, as I would come to see when I witnessed the outbreak of interspecies war in a highway rest stop driving through Arizona. I had purchased an old sailboat, which I wanted to use to explore the Pacific, and I kept this boat in Ventura, California. I lived then in a shack in the southern desert mountains of New Mexico, and the drive between the boat and the shack took almost exactly 13 hours on Interstate 10. In the 3 years it took me to rebuild the boat, I seemed to almost live on that highway. All the rest areas in three states became as familiar as my home. At first it was not too crowded. Sometimes on the weekends there would be what might be called excessive traffic, but I confined my driving to the weekdays, and it did not get thick until I was close to Southern California. But then air travel became more and more difficult and time-consuming due to enhanced security, and driving grew much more attractive and comforting, and consequently, the highway quickly became a thronging hive of cars, trucks, vans, thousands, it seemed, of motorcycles, and huge families traveling together, especially approaching any holiday, like Easter or Christmas. As an adjunct to this increase in traffic, the population at the highway rest areas virtually exploded. It was common to find no parking spaces available, and even more common to see crowds of people, scores, hundreds of them, stopping to rest, stretch, get a drink of water, more on this later, and, it seemed, let their children run wild. And this fact, children running amok, was perhaps the primary factor leading to the war. All the rest areas were built along isolated stretches of the highway, sensibly, since you want them where other facilities were not available. And it must be noted that the surrounding country where they were located was stark desert, and not exactly crawling with wildlife. Still, what wilderness there was quickly came into contact, perhaps a better word would be collision, with the area itself, and the people who were stopping there. First, the birds. I had spent almost my entire life misjudging birds. For some reason, I thought them stupid, and then found initially, from parrots, minor birds, crows, and ravens, that they are indeed not only not ignorant and stupid, but in many cases, smarter than people. Still later, I found that even the smallest birds, sparrows, wrens, chickadees, had wonderful innate intelligence, could work complicated math problems, and live, actually make a living and a family, and live, in weather and conditions that would drop a human dead in his tracks. It was in fact in the rest areas in the deserts of Arizona and New Mexico that I first saw the smaller birds make use of this intellect. It was as a child in the Philippine Islands that I saw larger birds make use of thinking ability. In 1946, we lived in a camp outside of Manila, which came in constant contact with belligerent soldiers called hooks. They would attack the fences at night and were driven off with machine gun fire. This fire was often deadly accurate and resulted in casualties among the attackers, so often that it was quite usual in the mornings to see their bodies along the wire. Many of these attackers carried rations, most often rice balls. There were wild chickens almost everywhere, literally thousands of them, and they soon came to learn that machine gun fire resulted in a chance to get at the rations or other food, and they would come running if they heard automatic weapons firing, trying to find the rice balls among the bodies of the casualties. I was walking down a gravel road one day past a machine gun post when they fired a short burst in the air to check out some part of their weapon. Machine gun fire was very common, and I was surprised to see dozens of chickens come running out of the brushy jungle as if attacking the machine gun position, clearly disappointed when there were no bodies to check. Similarly, the small birds in the rest areas began to learn that the automobiles and trucks that came roaring in brought with them a wonderful smorgasbord of insects caught and carried in their radiator grills. Especially as spring came and the insects began their chains of reproduction, radiators became literally packed with insects, and birds flocked to the moving harvest. At first there was some confusion and open bickering, while the truck grills were spread and open and bigger birds could get at them. Many of the smaller compact cars were limited, and only small birds could get inside. Still, in the beginning, the bigger birds would try the smaller cars, get trapped, and raise Holy Hannah trying to get out before the tourists drove off with them trapped inside. They seemed to learn fast, however, and soon, within days and even hours in some cases, small birds were hitting small cars and larger birds were hitting the trucks and larger vehicles. It seemed, however, to go almost too smoothly, and I spent more time at one of the busier rest areas and learned after lengthy study that the choreography was being controlled by some of the larger birds. These birds were scraggly-looking black birds. We used to call them grackles. They were just a bit smaller than crows, moving in migration in large, sometimes huge, flocks. They were individually very pushy, almost cocky or snappy birds, seemingly quick to anger and push others around, much as the behavior they would use to keep someone from messing with their nest. They would rush and peck at both small and large birds who were feeding in the wrong size vehicle, and furthermore, they policed each vehicle to make certain the birds assigned to their radiator did a good job of cleaning out the bug carcasses. Or so it looked. In any event, I was stunned at what I was watching, the organization, the conceptualization, the pure order of what I was seeing floored me. And then it changed again, grew. The grackles seemed to study what they had done and decided there was another ingredient, or perhaps a further dynamic, that threatened to upset the order. The people. In the rapid movement and shuffle of birds and vehicles and radiator grills, the tourists did not seem to recognize their positional importance in the flow of order. To wit, if they came back to their cars or trucks too soon, the birds at that particular radiator would miss out on some amount of food. It was too clearly a waste, and the grackles set out at once to remedy the situation. If they saw somebody heading for their car before they thought it was time, they would use the defend the nest procedure, diving and fluttering their wings and pecking at the person's hair to alarm them and push them back from their cars. It was not 100% effective, but it started a kind of discomfort or panicked reaction, and people in general, there were about 30 people at that time in the rest area, with 10 or 15 arriving and departing, began moving in back and forth directions without quite knowing why they did so. At this moment, the bees entered the picture, taking over the water and finishing the job of conquering the rest area. Obviously, it was not a planned operation. How could it be? But the effect was the same. The water inside the bathrooms was not potable and was separate and sealed in the rooms by tight doors. This threw the only supply of drinking water on a small drinking fountain about 20 feet from the bathroom doors. And the heavy use of this fountain, and perhaps lack of maintenance, had caused it to leak with a steady trickle, so that there was water there all the time, and not just when the button was pushed. This was on a very hot day, in the middle of the Arizona desert. Water was so valuable to all living things as to be virtually incalculable, and a colony of bees, I think killer bees, based on their aggressiveness, but I wasn't sure how to tell, discovered the steady stream of fresh, cool water about the same time as a troop of traveling schoolchildren from two vans with some kind of church group. The children were thirsty and crowded around the fountain. The bees were thirsty and decided to defend the same fountain. The grackles became furious because traffic to and from the vehicles wasn't moving right, and so they lined up to begin dive-bombing just about everybody. There was a moment, just a moment, like the hesitation in a cheap Western movie just before the gunfight starts. Then it broke loose. A bee, or perhaps two or three, hit a child, or perhaps two or three. Somebody screamed. I got in my car. And everybody ran everywhere, yelling and screaming as the bees continued their attack, and the grackles, joined by other birds, kept trying to herd them. Some got into the wrong vehicles, any port in a storm. Some ran for the toilets, irrespective of gender. Quite a few of them just ran. I swear I saw a trucker making close to 20 miles an hour in rubber flip-flops heading out for the freeway. And not a few loped off into the desert, where they discovered cactus, assorted thorns, and heaven knows how many different kinds of stinging bugs and reptiles. It was, all in all, a grand example of interspecies lack of cooperation, and the further illustration that might makes right. I stayed in the rest area, in my car, for another half an hour, until everything had settled down, and saw who emerged as the victor. The bees kept the water fountain.
Chapter 5. On the need for a murder of ravens to maintain control of just about everything, and laughing dinosaurs. Living in nature is so strange. Memories take on life, a valid life, that is more vital, more real than the actual events. It is, in some sense, much like scurvy, an illness brought about by a lack of vitamin C, common to sailors and navies of old, who could not carry enough fresh food on long sailing voyages. One of the prime symptoms of scurvy, of advanced scurvy, along with complete tooth loss and eventual madness and death, was that old wounds or ancient surgeries would open up and become fresh, with all the attendant pain and horror. A combat wound, well healed, such as a leg blown off by cannon fire, would become new, open, horrible, even after decades of healing. And so with memories from nature. An accident, say from a moose attack or the like, perhaps because there is more time to dwell upon it, does not lessen, but in some ways grows, fills out. It would be a true nightmare, except that at the same time, good, sweet memories are given even more strength, more reality. I can remember with incredible detail my grandmother baking me an apple pie and sitting with me with two glasses of chilled whole milk on a day when I stepped on a rusty 16-penny nail sticking through an old board at the back of the barn. The nail is almost gone from my mind, but the pie, with sugar and cinnamon sprinkled on top, hot from the oven, the cold milk, my grandmother's soothing melodic voice telling me in Norwegian that I, that it, would all be fine, has filled the memory with such pleasantness, such joy, that there is no room for the misery. And the same rule seems to apply to all natural memories. I have written much about the woods, being in the woods, being in nature, as it was for me a very real kind of sanctuary, a safe place, a truly safe place, a beautiful place. And yet... I have been attacked by moose, charged by bear, run down by feral dog packs, struck by rattlesnakes, bump attacked by sharks, even put on top of my car by an angry weasel not much bigger than my thumb. I thought later that he might have rabies, but at the time I merely jumped in fear. It's just that those things don't seem to have the weight, the measureless beauty of countless sunsets and dawns.
the simple grace and clear glory of nature. And besides, often it is the bad things that turn out to be the best. I fell off a dog sled down a frozen waterfall and landed on sharp ice on a kneecap. It was so agonizing, I thought, seriously, that my heart would stop. But I found that my whole dog team loved and worried about me so much, they curved downstream and worked back up to me to surround me as I lay clutching my lacerated knee, whimpering and pushing their warm bodies against me. I remember the love, the dog love, much more than the shattered knee. And it was one of the ugliest of things that brought ravens into my life and made them my medicine bird. It is perhaps true that nobody should trap wild animals. I have done so, as a young boy, and then, when destroyed financially and forced to go back to the woods as an adult for a couple of years. I wasted nothing, fed the meat to my dogs or ate it myself, tanned or sold the pelts, did everything legal by state and federal law, worked within the ecology to help keep a correct balance in nature. And yet, if there is such a thing as hell, I think I will be consigned there for trapping. The animals had no choice in it, and even if the state tells you beaver must be thinned because they are ruining highways, or coyotes must be taken as they are wiping out sheep ranchers, the animals still do not understand or know these things, how we work. They simply know they are alive one day and dead the next, for no apparent reason. And so I think that even if there is a reason, it may be wrong. Still, there is something worse than just trapping, and that is to trap without sense or judgment or responsibility. And shame that it may be, such things happen. It is how I met ravens. I was trapping in northern Minnesota, and somebody had crossed my line and set steel leghold traps, I used only snares, with bait, which was illegal, and hung the meat bait on a wire directly up and over the trap, forcing an animal to stand in the trap to reach the bait. Also illegal. Plus, they were fairly large traps. I was running my team up a small frozen creek when I came around a corner and saw a raven caught in a number 4 steel trap. Drawn by the bait, he had stepped full on the trip pad, and the jaws had caught his foot before he could react and escape. By one toe. Just the end of it. Barely. And he was absolutely furious. I mean, there is anger and frustrated anger, or anger mixed with fear, or anger mixed with only slightly diluted, rabid madness. And he was all of them, way past all of them. He was huge, like a big, black, squawking, enraged, and murderous turkey. And if he had a gun, or a knife, or access to a nuclear device, I would have been gone instantly. A flock of ravens is called a murder, and now I could see why. The dog team was barreling up the creek and was drawn in by his commotion, and I barely got the sled stopped and tied off to a tree before they got to him. They would have torn him to pieces, but he didn't care. He jerked at the chain and tried to get loose, not to get away from the dogs, but to get at them. I mean, it was complete insanity. "A minute," I said. "Let me get you out of here. It will just take a minute." I had seen crows and one other raven in traps, but never with this kind of rage. And the noise he was making, it was beyond even rudimentary infantry, truck driver, jailhouse swearing. I know he condemned me to 8 or 9 slow deaths. I stood on the 2 trap springs and released the jaws, and he pecked at my legs, slamming his beak against my thick winter pants. When he got loose, he flew up at my face before I could cover it, tried for my eyes, and then, I swear, whipped over backwards and took a shot at Cookie, my lead dog. Surprised, rather than rip him up, she ducked, and he swerved back at me, barely missed my eyes again, then wheeled up into a tree, where he sat, swearing. I gathered gear, left the trap triggered and hanging from a branch, and made my way back up the creek. He followed, swearing each time I stopped, with a language that clearly indicated he had many different words available for enraged cursing. Finally, at the end of the day, when I camped, he moved off, and I did not see him again. Or I should say, I did not see him again. But many times, past counting, in places where you would least expect it, often under duress or when things were either going bad or about to go bad, there would be a raven. Often silent, sometimes swearing, always pointedly looking at me, neck feathers ruffled, wings half out, beak extended. An example. I had sailed down from Alaska to California in my small boat, and for a good night's sleep, I had anchored in a cove south of Monterey called San Simeon, near where they built the Hearst Castle, just north of Morro Bay. I slept a solid night into mid-morning and was having a cup of tea in the new sun when I looked up, and just over the boat, straight up, glided an osprey, looking for a fish. He was beautiful and wonderfully graceful. Just as I wondered if I could get a picture of him up there in the sun, a raven came rushing in from the side and attacked him. This is not rare. All birds hate raptors and crows, and ravens attack them constantly. But this osprey was clever, and though the raven grabbed a wing feather, it twisted loose before the raven could peck his eyes, the common attack to cause blindness, and the osprey flew off, gaining altitude, and the raven dropped the feather and flew away as well. I watched as the feather drifted and circled and drifted down until it landed on my boat, not a foot from where I was standing. It was beautiful, clearly lined and barred, and I picked it up, felt that it was an omen of grace and flight, and tied it to the mast down inside the boat. A beautiful, innocent encounter, you might say. And so I thought. But remember the raven. Fully 8 months later, I was in a boatyard farther south in California, getting my bottom paint renewed, and there was a state or county peace officer in the same boatyard. We started talking, and I invited him aboard my boat for a cup of tea. We talked longer there about the sad state of the oceans, when suddenly he stopped and looked at the feather on the mast. "Where did you get that?" he asked. I told him in detail because I liked the story and there was such beauty in it. "That's a raptor feather." "I know. Isn't it beautiful?" "It's 5 years in a federal prison and a $25,000 fine." "Wow," I thought. "Some feather." He confiscated it and did not arrest me, for which I am eternally grateful, and I sailed on into my life. Perhaps a week later, while thinking of the incident again, I remembered something that had slipped my mind. The raven. He had pulled the wing feather out of the osprey, and he had dropped it, and it landed on me. And I know what seems obvious, that it was probably an accident. But I was the one who could have done 5 years in a federal prison, not the raven. And if it looks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, and walks like a duck, it's me. I'm the duck, not the raven. I would be the duck doing time. Proof of this possibly evil, or at least cantankerous connection, would come just a year later. Everything, it seems, moves in a circle. Life keeps whipping around and around, and on my last go-around, the Iditarod raised its furry canine head. I knew, or thought I knew, that I hadn't finished with it yet. I was wrong, of course, and old and brittle and not a little stupid, but I would have to break legs and arms and wrists and have another tooth kicked out before I began to believe in my own ability to commit errors. So I borrowed all the money I could, bought 46 dogs and a couple of sleds and an old house back in the woods in Alaska, 100+ miles north of Anchorage, and settled in to train for and run the Iditarod for the third time. I finished it in 1983 and almost finished it again in 1985. My body was then 65 years old, but my brain, in a scientific achievement of incredible adeptness, had stopped at the age of 38 or so, and with wonderful abilities of delusion convinced me that this would all work. What's even more amazing is that I am now sitting here writing this at the age of 73, and what passes through my brain is still working at me to go back and try it again. It is like a symphony musician who stops playing a piece on a hanging note, and he cannot rest until he finishes the note. So I went back again, put the dogs on the glacier in Juneau, and moved farther north to build a kennel, which was when I ran into the grizzly bear, then went to the pound and got Corky the poodle to watch my back. He is sitting behind me now. Although he is very old, losing vision and hearing, he's still watching, still in his mind only 38 or so, in people years, fully capable of taking out a grizzly, in his mind. So we worked all that summer, put in a kennel, bought 6 old freezers for dog food, brought the dogs back from the glacier in late fall, began feeding meat, and then the company came. Full circle, remember? The ravens. Leo, my friend and dog handler, who is taking care of the dogs now as I work in the lower 48 on some business problems, was originally from the city, and it was a jolt to move into the bush, as it would be for anybody. When the ravens first came, it was one or two birds. They sat in the trees around the kennel simply observing, taking notes, which they shared with one another using bill clicking as a form of semi-telegraphic communication. We had acquired 4 all-terrain vehicles, 2 small ones and 2 slightly larger, which we pulled with teams on woodland trails before there was snow for sleds. It worked the dogs harder than the light aluminum and plastic sleds, and so we started them right off on a strong meat diet, beef hearts, which we purchased in 60-pound boxes and cut into small 1-inch chunks when we fed. And the 2 scout ravens, as we found them to be, saw this meat. While they are largely omnivorous, anything as rich and full of energy as straight heart meat could not be ignored, and after a week, the 2 birds left and returned the next day with 28 friends. We suddenly had 30 ravens, and they set out immediately to rearrange our situation so it would be their situation, much as the birds and bees had done in the highway rest areas. First, they had to train the dogs. 40 or so sled dogs, stone carnivores, each in his own insulated house with a 12-foot chain, capable of lightning-fast reflexes and lunges, require a lot of training. And the ravens set out immediately with a distinct method. 3 ravens would hang around a specific dog, teasing him by getting closer and then jumping back, working at him most of a day, tease and jump, until finally the dog would get sick of it and begin to ignore the ravens. Then would come feeding time, twice a day. Each dog got a large bowl with beef heart and commercial dog food mixed with warm water. They loved it, hit it like wolves, and the ravens would have to move off, start over, and retrain them. Initially, it was slow work, but the dogs had been preconditioned by the daily training, and 2 ravens would come at the bowl from the side, drawing the dog away, while a 3rd hit the food and dragged off a piece of meat. They would do this again and again until at last, at long last, and the ravens were wonderfully patient, the dog would sit back, relax, and simply let the ravens pick through and take out the best parts before letting the dog have his go. We, the humans, were being trained as well, in that we added special bits of meat for the ravens so the dogs wouldn't go hungry. I once saw a kennel in Canada where they fed more than 100 puppies twice a day in large rubberized circular dish troughs, and when it came time to feed, the puppies, trained to a T, ran screaming in circles around the dishes until the ravens, perhaps 50 of them, had carefully and slowly picked through the food for themselves before letting the pups in. Having trained us and our dogs, it took about 2 weeks to complete, the Ravens set about altering, or trying to alter, the rest of our regimen to fit their needs. They hated the four small all-terrain vehicles, either due to the noise of the motors or